Hello and welcome to the Inis Guarda YouTube podcast series, powered and inspired by openbusinesscouncil.org and citiesabc.com. As we've been doing on this series, our focus is to profile world leaders and personalities that are actually changing the way we think and helping us moving forward in the areas of business and technology, which is the focus of this series. I want to thank you, my audience, for being here since the beginning. The ones there are and the new ones, please welcome on board. We've been actually having an audience of 145,000 people, and we are actually reaching over 15 million views, which I'm very grateful to have you all here and to continue growing this global experience that is this podcast YouTube series. I want to welcome to our series today two fantastic authors, minds and personalities that have global reputation in the different areas of their expertise, and then as well two great human beings that have I would say a fantastic capacity to look at problems and solve them independent of their wealth of knowledge and expertise and as well their achievements. So I welcome to our series Des Dearlove, a great name by the way, that is a British business journalist, management theorist and a prolific author. He is the co-founder of the platform and really one of the most authority organizations, Thinkers 50, the first global ranking of management thinkers that was created or co-created with Stuart Crater. So Des is he studied politics and economics from the University of Southampton, and there's an extensive background in journalism. He's a former columnist to the London Times and contributing editor to the Strategy Plus Business. And he was the co-editor with Stuart Craner of the Financial Times and Book of Management. As an author, Des has recently released the compilation titled Certain Uncertainty, which is the focus of this podcast. That is a book that the title, I repeated, Certain Uncertainty, Leading with Agility and Resilience in an Unpredictable World. That was released as a co-brand book series in collaboration with Wiley and Thinkers 50. In Uncertain Certainty, Des and the 30 authors that he brought discuss how to build resilience and agility into our lives and business, and how we and the authors go through and advise and fresh thinking how to deal with these very important disruptive times that we live in. Des is as well a prolific author and co-written several books and a lot of papers and articles. Some of them Generation Entrepreneur, FT.com, Gravity Training Inside the Business of Business Schools, Josie Bass, and The Ultimate Book of Business Thinking, Capstone. And another important thing, because I love books, as you guys know, Des Dearlove also has written fiction books under the pen name of D.D. Everest, and he has author Archie Green, a trilogy for children, published by Favor and Favor in 2014, and as well The Magician's Secret, that was shortlisted for the National UK Book Awards. And as well, he is as well a guest lecturer and has been teaching in business leading schools, including IE Business School and Said Business School of Oxford University, where he is an associate fellow. My second author is a lady and a professor as well, that is a world recognized leader in the areas of leadership. And I welcome Megan Ritz, that is a professor of leadership and dialogue at Alt Business School. And she's listed on Thinkers 50 ranking of global management thinkers, and as well in publications like HR Magazine, most influential listing. She's an expert in leadership and dialogue, which is an area more important than ever, always in business. But she's as well an inspiring author that was recently shortlisted for both the Radar and Breakthrough Idea Awards. And she is a contributor in this book that I mentioned, Certain Uncertainty, on a chapter that is dialogue and about how to look at different areas in work. Megan writes, speaks, and consults in the areas of leadership, and dialogue, mindfulness, cultural change, coaching, and team effectiveness. She's author of Mind Times and Dialogue in Organizations and Speak Up, Say What Needs to Be Said and Hear What Needs to Be Heard for Financial Times Publishing, which was shortlisted for the CMI Management Book of the Year 2020. She's a PhD Leadership and Dialogue from Cranfield School of Management and a doctoral work focused on how leadership and dialogue are constructed in organizations and serves as a call to examine and inquire into the quality of our relationships within organizational settings. Megan founded Reeds Consulting, where she works with a number of international clients, bringing her research to organizations through facilitation, teaching, and speaking. And her business background includes consulting in Deloitte, People and Change Services area, and she has been as well an analyst in the strategy consulting arm of Computer Science Corporation and in supplier strategy and relationship management for NLT and the internet startup Boo.com. Welcome to our series. I'm very excited to have you here. So I'll start first by, Des, if you could introduce yourself for our audience, a bit of your background, and as well, how do you reach to this moment?
Gosh. Well, thank you, Dennis, for the opportunity to share a little bit of the Thinkers 50 story, a little taste of the journey that I've been on for the last 20 years. So I co-founded Thinkers 50 back in 2001 with my co-founder, Stuart Craner. We were working as journalists at the time. And you mentioned books. At that point, we were writing a lot about management and about the management books that were coming out. And what had begun as a sort of a trickle of business books had by the late 1990s become a torrent, to the point where managers and leaders were overwhelmed by all these books coming out. So Stuart and I, as journalists, took it upon ourselves to create a sort of a consumer guide, really. That's what we set out to achieve. So that busy managers and leaders could sort the, as it were, the nuggets of real gold from the fool's gold. So that's how Thinkers 50 began life. And we published the first Thinkers 50 global ranking of management experts, management thinkers, in 2001. Is that enough?
No, I would like to go a bit deeper.
Okay.
so if you can tell, because just for people listening to us, of course, I mentioned about Thinkers 50 introduction, but of course, this is a very high-profile organization and as well, I would say, an ecosystem, let's put it that way. But as well, you've been running it for 24 years and 4 months, according to your LinkedIn, which is quite an impressive 2 decades and a half. Let's start with your background. You said you're a journalist, a bit of your background, education, and okay. How did you create Thinkers 50? Just let's go through that first.
Okay. So I grew up in a relatively middle-class family. I went to a very ordinary state school. My parents were both entrepreneurs, which I think probably has had an influence as I've grown up. If you grow up with entrepreneurs, and by the way, neither of them made squillions of dollars selling their business like the Silicon Valley people. They ran very, very ordinary businesses which just about paid the mortgage at the end of the month. But growing up with people who ran their own businesses meant that the dinner time conversation was always about business. It was always about what they'd done that day and what they were planning to do in the future. So I think that probably had an influence. I then went on to university and studied politics and economics. Realized at the end of my 3-year university degree that actually what I wanted to be was a writer. I wanted to write books. But unfortunately, I probably should have studied English, but anyway, I'd done politics and economics for various reasons. And the only way I really knew how to do that, to make a living as a writer, was as a journalist. The idea of being a novelist or anything as highfalutin as that wasn't really something. I didn't have any experience of that. So I went into journalism and started working at newspapers and being a freelance journalist. And by one way or another, I ended up at the London Times. So I wrote a column for the London Times. And while I was there, I met another journalist called Stuart Craner. And the two of us started working together. And we started specializing in management and management, in particular, management ideas and management books. And so therefore, over time, we were doing book reviews, we were interviewing the authors. We got to know that world of that we all call thought leadership now. We got to know it quite well. But we found there was by the late 1990s, there was a problem. And the problem was there were just the sheer volume of books that were coming out meant that leaders and managers couldn't possibly stay on top of all the ideas that were coming through in thought leadership. So Stuart and I decided it would be a good idea to create a ranking of the management and business thinkers or gurus. And that's how Thinkers 50 came to be born. It was very much at the time, you know, a journalistic endeavor because people like rankings. We thought that we would be able to be like a which book, which thinker of a kind. So that's what we set out to do. And I mean, we had quite a grand vision because we said we want the Thinkers 50 will be the world's most reliable resource for identifying, ranking and sharing the leading management ideas of our age, ideas that can make a positive difference in the world. So that was our mission back then and is still our mission to this day.
So now it's much better. Thank you so much. That's amazing because I'm a huge fan of Thinkers 50. And effectively, it's a platform, an ecosystem that I suggest people listening to us to look and finding ways of, first of all, finding the best authors on these areas. And as well to understand what is happening around the trends, around the books, around a lot of thought leadership around these areas, which is key for anyone in business, especially nowadays where the complexity is becoming more and more. And whatever you are, academic or not, you need to deal with all these different things. So I have a lot of questions on this, and I know that you have limited time. But before I go to more about Thinkers 50 and about your trajectory, I would like, of course, to welcome Megan Reitz. And Megan, you have a much broader academic background as an author and as well an academic and as a professor of leadership in the Yale Business School, which is of course a very prestigious business school, and as well you wrote a chapter for the last book that is part of the focus of this book. But before we go to that, tell us a bit about you and as well both your academic experience but as well your thought leadership experience and anything personal you want to share with the audience.
Okay, how long have you got? Let me say, I'm British. I was born on a little dairy farm in England. My dad was a dairy farmer. We had a tenanted council-run dairy farm. My mum was a teacher. So I grew up in the great outdoors with a wild imagination and parents that were both passionate about what they did. And they did what, and they worked incredibly hard for us, but because they loved what they did. And I studied, obviously, land economy, law, property, and economics at university, which I thoroughly enjoyed, but I had no clue what I wanted to do afterwards. So I went traveling for it wasn't supposed to be a couple of years. It ended up being a couple of years. I went backpacking to find myself. Unfortunately, I didn't manage to find myself, so I had no clue what I wanted to do when I got back either. So I did something that's really good idea if you don't know what you want to do, and that's you become a consultant. So I joined a strategy consultancy, and I really enjoyed that. And one thing that I became very curious with was the fact that we created these, you know, beautiful strategies, and they just weren't really implemented, or at least when they were implemented, it didn't look anything like it did on the PowerPoint that I just produced. So that started to make me quite curious. And then in the 90s, obviously the internet industry kicked off. For those listeners that were even alive at that point, I joined a rather infamous organization called boo.com, which, you know, was sort of worth over $1 billion and then worth nothing very, very quickly. But in that period of time, you know, virtually everybody was in their 20s. We didn't really know what was going on, but we were very experimental. And I ended up running a team of a big team of people across the US and in Europe and in the UK with zero management knowledge whatsoever. So actually thoroughly enjoyed completely messing up mainly through that. And I was really interested, just so interested in people and just how do you have a team of people and how can you help create the kind of environment where they can do really good work and enjoy what they're doing? And I was very interested in organizational change as well. And so after obviously going traveling again to still find myself, I came back and I joined Deloitte. So I became a consultant again, but this time much more in people and organizational change. And I wanted to learn how to do it. And I thought, well, Deloitte will have the method. And indeed, they did have a methodology, which taught me a lot. But it still didn't, it didn't satisfy my curiosity in relation to people and how they work with one another, really, what really goes on. So off I went to, at the time, Ashridge, which is now part of Holt International Business School. And I've been there for a long time and running two big research projects over the last 8 or 9 years. One project is called Speaking Truth to Power. And that is about our habits of how we speak up and who we listen to in our systems. And the other project is called The Mindful Leader. And essentially, I'm interested in how leaders are mindful of their actions when they're about, when they're taking them. So how are they mindful of their habits? And how can they spot when they're about to do what they've always done and make a different choice? That's essentially at the heart of all leadership development. And so I'm interested in how we train that. It's also at the heart of ethical conduct and relationships. So now, to draw that to a close, I find myself still obsessed with how we show up at work, with how we engage in dialogue with the power systems that we try and navigate, the kind of performances and the way we try and seem to others and how authentic or not we can be together and the kind of conversations that really, really matter and direct our future. That's what I'm fascinated in. And this is a really important point. I am a mother of two teenage daughters. And frankly, that just floors everything else. And if I manage to get through that in one piece, that will be my greatest achievement.
Wow, wonderful. And you're a great speaker. So it's amazing. So I love that energy. And I love as well that you start with your parents, because I think a lot of these interviews that I do, and I think we're getting close to 300, and we had here ministers and a lot of high profile personalities, but it's about the people first and all this background that we do and the relationships we create. So I love the energy that you guys bring, but as well the knowledge and wisdom. So I'll come back to you, Des. There's a lot of questions. I think we have to have a separate set of interviews, but for today, I'll try to keep synthetic. So Des, in terms of, let's start before I go to the book, which is the purpose of this interview. So Think is 50. So I mentioned the time, but let's look a bit of the history, some of the achievements, because for people listening to us, and I'm sure if people are interested in management, for sure they found Think is 50, which is one of the biggest organizations in terms of highlighting and ranking, like you mentioned, the thought leaders and the management in the world, but as well as achieved a lot of fantastic benchmarks in multiple different layers. So if you could actually talk about how did it came out, a bit of the history, and what it stands now.
Sure. Well, hopefully just listening to Megan, you've got an idea of Megan is absolutely, she's in our ranked in our top 50, and it's that sort of mind and research and work that we try to shine a light on. So yeah, hopefully, you know, Megan is a great advert for Thinkers 50 and, you know, our ability to identify the right people. So let me go back to the beginning, brief history. In, as I say, in 2001, when Megan was working for Boo.com, because it was all falling apart in about 2001.
Yeah, no, we were over by that stage.
Oh, yeah, okay, you already got it. Because I think that was like the last, you know, the last hurrah, I think. Anyway, in 2001, we launched our first global ranking, first ever Thinkers 50. And it was part of actually an organization called FT Dynamo, Financial Times Dynamo. Unfortunately, FT Dynamo also went the same way as Boo.com and actually didn't survive, you know, the cull that happened about then. But at least it was the platform that we launched on. So Stuart and I were left with this creation of our own Thinkers 50 with no particular home for it. So we carried on doing it. We've published the ranking every 2 years since 2001. In 2011, we added the Distinguished Achievement Awards, the Thinkers 50 Distinguished Achievement Awards, which the Financial Times at the time very helpfully described as the Oscars management thinking. And it was the first time we'd done a live event to announce the ranking, and we announced the winners of the 10 awards, as I say, as became known as the Oscars of management thinking. So that was 2011. Then in 2015, the next kind of big step forward was we introduced Thinkers 50 Radar, which is a list published every January of the 30 most exciting new voices in management, the up and coming new thinkers. So this is the talent spotting, people who are going to hope come through the system and eventually end up in the ranking. At the same time, also in 2015, at the other end of the cycle, as it were, we also introduced the Thinkers 50 Hall of Fame, because we didn't particularly want to see, you know, very distinguished thinkers who perhaps aren't, you know, producing books and ideas as much as they did in the past. We didn't want to see those people tumbling out of the ranking. So we created a sort of a Mount Rushmore, a pantheon of the gods, where they could be ushered gently into a retirement, but also still recognizing and honoring the contribution that they'd made. So those two pieces sort of came together, the new talent and making space in the ranking, as it were, for people who had done distinguished service and made a huge contribution to management, but perhaps, you know, weren't doing their most important work anymore. So those two enhancements in 2015, and then in 2022, we introduced our two new lists, book lists. So there's the Thinkers 50 Classic Management and Business Books, which are the 10 books which have stood the test of time, all the way back to people like Drucker and Charles Handy and Tom Peters and people from, you know, way back when. And then we also have the Thinkers 50, the best new books. So they're the books that we recommend that managers, if they, you know, we're all busy these days, but if there's 10 books on that list that we think are worth reading. So that completes the six lists, but it's also a sort of a history of Thinkers 50. But we're also 2023, every other year, when we announce the ranking, we have a big event in London where we gather together the thought leaders of the world and people come from all over the world. And 2023 is a Thinkers 50 year. So we are holding the awards gala at the Guildhall in London, which is one of London's most historic and iconic venues. And so the great and the good of thought leadership will be gathering in the Guildhall in London on November the 5th and November the 6th of this year.
Well, first of all, congratulations. It's a fantastic trajectory and definitely the depth of knowledge and wealth of knowledge. And as well, like you said, the summary, because there's so much research on this, but you very easily can get lost. Mm-hmm. And I think, like both of you said, one of the challenges right now is how you put theory, practice, and personal life. And as well, right now, we have the additional challenge of all the technology innuendos that are coming, and they're becoming a bit more disruptive, or not a bit, much more disruptive. So before I go to the book, one last question to you, Megan, and then I go to the book, so because I know that we have limited time. So Megan, you touched three areas that for me are key. So one, of course, was your personal background. The other one was your academic and research, and then your professional achievements and as well the work you've been doing professional in different levels. But as well, you touch, of course, the fact that you're a mother and the fact as well that you went through companies that suddenly were up and then very down. So this is actually, it touches actually to the book, Certain and Uncertainty. But one of the things that I would like to ask from your experience and how you actually met each other, I think it's always an interesting thing as well, is how do you keep this theory practice balance? Because that's probably, I think, one of the challenges that all of us that want to do good business, and you mentioned ethics as well, and how we can do that to get results but keep things grounded. Because it's even in the education of children, and you have two daughters, I have as well a daughter and two children, and I know that it's quite difficult, especially teenagers, to keep the balance of discipline, the balance of theory, the balance of practice. So this is not different in business and much and in academia as well. So a bit of how you deal with all these balls and these different complexities.
That's a very good question. Firstly, on the theory practice split, I think in a lot of my work and with the method and the approach I have to the world, there isn't really a split between the two. So when I am in organizations and with leadership teams, doing kind of practicing, if you like, and intervening and facilitating, that is the process where I'm also researching and I'm testing out new theory. So I'm what they call an action researcher. So a lot of my work is involved with reflection on experience. And then the creation of a kind of idea and an experiment, which is then put into action and then reflected on. And so the cycle continues. And so for me, that's where my ideas come from, deep dwelling with experience in the moment with others. And all those bits are really important. And I mentioned the with others as I think Des will agree that, you know, one of the things about ranking systems is that they tend to, they put spotlights on individuals. And I mean, my co-author in my last book, Speak Up, was John Higgins. Co-author in my book before that, Mind Time, was Michael Chaskelson. And it is work with others who are in the moment grappling with situations of uncertainty and creating the spaces in those moments where you can reflect, theorize, and experiment. That's what I think, that's the kind of method that I really enjoy using. And I also think that it results in more pragmatic understandings as well. And I think I'm probably interested in more in the nuances and the complexities than I am in the sort of simple solutions for things. So that's the bit that interests me. And the reason why I'm passionate about people is that there will never be an answer. You know, there's never an answer. And there's never a, oh, this is how you do dialogue. Ah, this is how you react and respond in situations of uncertainty. It will always be an experimentation. It will always require reflection and learning with others. As we may come on to in a bit, though, what I would say is that in order to do that well, you need to create spaces for yourself and with others where you can step back and reflect and have dialogue. And that's one of the most pressing challenges that I think exists in our organizational systems. We are pathologically busy at the same time as having such breakneck advances, in inverted commas, advances in technology, that we are in danger of purely going on automatic. So doing kind of making decisions without really having the capacity to hear different voices and make those reflections and those experiments before we head down certain paths. So one of the things that I'm most interested in now is spaciousness. How do we create a sense of spaciousness so that we can make wise choices, even in systems that make that so hard to do. So I may well have gone completely off on a tangent there, Dennis, but I think that's also relevant in my personal life as well. You know, one of the problems with teenage daughters is that, you know, I quite like to control things. You know, I quite like to control. I quite like to have steps in place. It's the same in the workplace. I like to kind of think, right, I know how to do this. If I do steps 1, 2, and 3, we'll be fine. Well, you know that that definitely doesn't happen with teenagers. And therefore, how do I cope with not knowing? How do I cope with not being in control, but being an influence? Where does that leave me? And how do I be the best that I can be in that situation? So my personal life and my professional life are weirdly intermingled. You know, how do I have good conversations at home? How do I enable my daughters to tell me what they need to tell me? You know, that gives me as much understanding about workplace conversations as being in the workplace.
Now, that's interesting. And of course, I mean, the job of a teenager is to resist the control of their parents. That's the process they're going through. They're going through a process of separation in order to be able to gain their own control. So, no, it's an interesting management experiment that you're conducting.
Yes, I think it's Amy Edmondson that's doing a lot of work on failure at the moment. So yeah. She needs to speak with me on that.
That's right. Doing the wrong thing for the right reasons. I think is the theme of the book. Amy Edmondson, we should say, is number one in the Thinkers 50 ranking at the moment, Harvard Business School professor and the originator of psychological safety, which is a fantastic, I hope, example of the sorts of ideas that we try to champion at Thinkers 50. And what I love about Amy's work is that psychological safety is now entered not just the business lexicon, but you hear people in the pub talking about psychological safety. I was lucky enough to interview a former astronaut, you know, who went up in a rocket, basically. And he was saying that some of the problems they had at NASA, you know, back in the day when they had the accidents, he said, was because there was a lack of psychological safety. So even in places like NASA, that language has permeated. And that's the power of some of these ideas that we try to champion. That Amy's work is now, as I say, it's entered into family life. I think it's certainly entered into pub conversation. And it's, you know, it's everywhere, as it should be, because it's a really important idea.
It's one of the things that the for people listening to us in the thinkers50.com, there's a lot of information about the authors and a lot of summary and snapshots that you can actually get. And I love the interaction between both of you, because like you said, Megan, is the complexity, how you take these things, and you went very well into all these different things. And I love that that you're trying to make the different things and control and complexity and put it all in our orchestra, which is not easy, but it's part of our lives, especially when you deal with these things. So let's go to the book. So the book is for people listening to us, Certain Uncertainty, Living with Agility and Resilience in an Unpredictable World. So it's a book created by Des, Dear Love, here. And the book, of course, has a big amount of authors. And I have a couple of questions, and I want to understand how did the book came out, first of all, because, of course, you guys are dealing with so much wealth of experience and as well wealth of knowledge. But one of the things that is key that the book highlights, and I will quote some of the things that I prepared for the meeting, says, and I will be quoting some summaries for people listening to us. So two parts. So constant disruption is the new reality. What is certain today is uncertainty. What does this mean for the business leaders of tomorrow? What do the next generation of leaders need to know about living with certain uncertainty? And this is actually a fantastic part, which is part actually of the chapter that you actually wrote on Thinkers 50 in the blog about the book. And then there's a quote from you, Des, that I want to highlight as well. Leaders need to go off their old ways of control and concepts of economic and social uncertainty and embrace forward-looking humility about what lies around the corner. So So of course I want to know how the book came, and I lied. Of course I will not lie. I lied to all the authors. You will do it, and we have of course Megan here. But one of the questions I have about the book. So the first question is of course for you to highlight the history of how the book came out and a bit about your summary of the book. The second one is, this is a very big problem we have right now, because it creates a huge problem that with uncertainty there's a lot of cynicism that comes. Point one. And then point two is that the ethics part that Megan mentioned becomes increasingly more difficult, because I'll speak for myself. I want to be nice. I want to make the team really very good culture, all these different things. And I read the books and I try to do as an author, as a CEO. But then, okay, I need results and I don't want the company to go down. How do you make all this complexity? And then, of course, there's the element that things that we learn now in 2 months might not be, let's look at ChatGPT that just 6 months ago didn't exist, okay? And now is the entire world economy is around this. And if you look at management and technology, academic world is having a massive impact, and that not even going to AI. So first question first, and the second, if you want to touch a bit about this topic, which is probably another interview of 40 minutes or 40, but nevertheless, if you can summarize.
So the I mean, Thinkers 50 is founded on three beliefs. One, ideas change the world. Two, management really does matter. Nothing happens without management in this world. I mean, that's just the fact of it. And number three, that fresh thinking can make a better future for all. So the book is really just an extension of our beliefs, if you like, and our values. Within the Thinkers 50 community, there is such a wealth of people with great ideas. And one of the frustrations is, well, you know, Dennis, how long a book takes in its gestation. In a traditional publishing model, it can be a very slow, there's all the pain of having to write the book, you know, even if you're very, very interested in the subject, which I hope we all are, the actual work of creating the book is usually a hard slog. And then it seems to take months and months and months before the book comes out, years sometimes. So we, with Wiley, the publisher, we've created a more of an accelerated publishing model, so that people with ideas, you know, that address real issues sort of in the current world, can get those ideas into the corporate bloodstream a bit quicker. So I have to say, my hats off to Wiley. They did a really good job of an accelerated publishing model. What we wanted to do was to be able to get ideas out there faster. And I think as we try to think of a theme, how we would cluster the ideas that were in the book, it became very clear that, I mean, 2022, and that one of the words of the year was, you know, permacrisis, this idea of a constant crisis after crisis. You know, it was highlighted as you know, the kind of the word of the year. So it felt very much like we were in a slightly different world, even though we knew change was unrelenting and ever increasing before the pandemic. Something seemed to switch, something seemed to change during, you know, the pandemic, where not only were so many people blindsided by that, even though in many ways you could say it was predictable that there would be a pandemic, but it was such a shock to business and such a shock to the system. And it feels happily and hopefully that now we're on the other side of that, at least that one, that particular pandemic. The world shifted a bit. And one of the big shifts is that I think there's a growing recognition that leaders don't have all the answers, and that they have to be agile, and we as a society need to be more resilient. So we wanted to give our Thinkers 50 community an opportunity to address that issue, and to get the ideas out as fast as we could into, as I say, into the corporate bloodstream. Curation, you know, my part in it is merely to curate some fantastic ideas and some brilliant people. And curation is very much, you know, at the heart of what Thinkers 50 does. We curate and we connect people and we connect ideas and we try to share ideas. So that was kind of the genesis of the book, if that makes sense. And as Amy Edmondson, who we were just talking about, her just referenced her work. Amy is number one in the ranking. She very kindly wrote a foreword for the book. And I think the first line of the book is, you know, the only certainty today is uncertainty. You know, the world continues to change at an ever, you know, faster pace. So it's to the point now, I think, where if a leader were to stand up and say that they had all the answers, I would be deeply suspicious of them. You know, I think a lot of people feel that. I think we saw the limitations of those leaders during the pandemic. We need people who can respond to what's in front of them and have the humility to admit that they don't have all the answers, but they're prepared to roll up their sleeves and to Megan's point, work with other people and solve problems as we go along, because that's the only way we're going to get through. And I always say, you know, if humanity has superpowers, has two superpowers, one of them is its ingenuity, its ability to solve problems. And the other one, hopefully, is its empathy, you know, the ability to put ourselves in the shoes of other people and care about each other. So, and I hope the book reflects some of those ideas.
Oh, it's very inspiring and really key. And I love the idea, as you summarize, ingenuity and empathy is key elements. And this brings us to your chapter, Megan. So your chapter is Voice of Difference at Work. So at the end of the day, to achieve this leadership, and we have, I would say, in terms of world leaders, we have effectively a lot of, I would say, crisis of leadership, because if you see the world leaders today, unfortunately, doesn't reflect the intelligence that you guys are reflecting here. I think probably we as authors and thought leaders and our politicians, there's a big problem. But that's another discussion that I want to touch that. But it touches as well the voices of difference at work, because we are all different. And if actually these leaders are part of our work. But tell us about your chapter, Megan, and how you deal with this difference and as well these topics that we are talking here with certainty and uncertainty.
So I'll build off what Des said there on two points. I would say that there's one more certain thing in uncertainty. And that's if you are, and maybe it isn't certain to some people, but if you're in a situation of uncertainty and we don't know what the situation is or will be, let alone what we should do wisely in it, we probably rely on having some very good conversations to figure it out. So one of the problems is, I'm going to generalize here, but for decades, in business schools and in quite a few business books, we've been teaching managers and leaders that good leadership is around, I am generalizing here, but good leadership is around basically knowing the answer, having a really good vision, communicating it in a way that's so compelling to everybody that they all agree with you and do what you say. Okay. Now, I have to say that's still an important skill. You will still need that practice, but you can't rely on it alone. We now need, and this is why I get really quite excited as a leadership professor, we now need leaders. I think we've probably always needed them, but now, especially after the pandemic, we realize that we need leaders that recognize that their perspective is partial. Okay. That they only know the world in their own experience. So they definitely have blind spots. Therefore, in order for a leader to make really good choices, they need to hear what those blind spots are. Yeah. And in order to do that, they need to be able to enable people to tell them. In particular, they need people that will disagree with them. Now, that's actually quite counter to what we've been teaching managers and leaders for decades in business schools. So part of the thing that I'm really interested in is, how do leaders hear what they need to hear? And there are some really good reasons why they're not hearing what they need to hear. So the first reason is that in most organizations, leaders point at the people that aren't speaking up, and they then try and fix those people. And they say, right, okay, they need to be braver and more courageous. Let's kind of send them on a workshop so that they can speak up. And they fail to understand that how they show up affects the other person's voice. So how do we show up in a way that enables people to speak to us? And that's a blind spot already for many leaders. And the other big blind spot. Two others I'll mention. One is that as soon as you've managed to persuade leaders that actually listening really is important, most leaders will then jump to the conclusion, that's okay because I'm already really good at it. Okay, so we've done research with, we've run a survey with over 17,000 employees globally now. And one thing is really clear. Most of us think we're really, really good at listening and that we're approachable. And the problem then is, you know, if I'm already a good listener, I don't need to do anything different. But we all suffer from what's called superiority illusion. We rate ourselves on our intent to listen. We rate other people on their behavior. There's a big gap. So again, another big blind spot. We've got leaders that kind of don't think it's their responsibility to help others to speak up. We've got leaders that think, actually, I'm pretty good at this already. And the other thing is that we then, you know, we're making some really great invitations to voices of difference in our workplace. You know, we're telling people to bring their whole selves to work, which has been a really popular phrase. And it's a lovely invitation, and it's long overdue, if you ask me. But we've got some employees that hear this invitation and they'll go, okay, so you want me to speak up? You want me to bring my whole self to work? Fantastic. About time you asked that. Let's talk about race. Let's talk about gender. Let's talk about climate change, because that's really important. And as far as I can see, it's a business issue. And so we have leaders and managers who aren't trained in going into conversations that they're not well practiced in. They're not trained in being okay with messing up, because we are having conversations around new territory. So if you think you're going to do that perfectly, you are in for a problem there. So, you know, how do we go into new sorts of conversations? If we can't go into new conversations, we can't transform the way that we're doing things by definition. And in an uncertain world that's moving really fast, we need to transform the way that we're responding to it. So how do we do that collectively? And I'm particularly interested in the leadership and the management role in that aspect, and getting it into new territory and new practice. I think it's a really exciting moment for the way that we think about leadership.
Yeah, I agree completely, and very important. Go.
No, just to add to what Megan was saying, I mean, and it's not because leaders are being nice that they need to have these conversations. They need the radar. They need to know. I mean, in order to do the job well in a world that's changing very rapidly, they need all the eyes and ears that they can get to understand what people are thinking and what is going on in the real world and what the context of their leadership is. So it's not a nice to have. These are essential skills for the leaders of the future, if they're going to be good leaders, if they're going to be effective, and if they're going to, you know, deliver where we started from. Dennis talking about performance as well. It's not just about, you know, it's not something, as I say, a nice to have. It's very much a need to have, because without it, we're left with the arrogant leaders of yesteryear.
Can I just make one more point?
Please.
I'll kick myself if I don't make this point really clearly. The way we make decisions is based on the kind of conversations and who says what and what gets heard, right? The main basis of what gets said and who gets heard in organizations relates to power, status, and authority. So the way we come to construct status and authority in our social systems and in our organizational systems. And so if we are to have conversations that go into new territories that examine the blind spots, that requires us to confront our systems of power and the way that we listen to some voices and not others. And so in my view as well, we can't respond differently to situations unless we get real about how we construct status and authority. And that's a fascinating area, but it's ironically an area that we're not comfortable talking about.
It's a very key element. So I have two questions, one for each of you. I know that you have limited time. For you, Des, the first question is, so the Certain Uncertainty book features 30 contributors from more than a dozen different countries. and provides, of course, a roadmap of practical ends on the strategy and so forth. So what would be like the summary of the book that you could actually give for people? Of course, I want people to get the book and read the book, because that's the idea as well of this podcast and as well learning with you guys and all these fantastic authors. But what would be like the summary that you strike you during with all these 30 mind powerful personalities and authors?
Gosh,
for you, and then I'll come to back.
I'll try and summarize.
I know, it's a difficult one.
I think, you know, so what differentiates this book from other books, perhaps, and other books in the space? I think we're fortunate to have access to a wealth of ideas and some really good thinkers. So it's partly to Megan's point, it's the diversity of thought, I think, and the diversity of perspectives. You mentioned how international the authors are. We're seeing people who are looking at the business world from a variety of different angles and from different disciplines. So I think that's one of its key strengths, is you've got such diversity of thought. We hope we do a decent job or a good job at Thinkers 50 in identifying the most talented business thinkers and management thinkers. And all of these people are drawn from the Thinkers 50 community. So I think there's a high quality threshold and a diversity of perspectives. And it's very future oriented. It challenges us to step out of the old paradigm and into a new paradigm. And I, at one point, I think in my introduction, I quote the late, great C.K. Prahalad, who actually topped the Thinkers 50 ranking on two occasions. And C.K. said, leadership is not an extrapolation of the current situation into the future, but it's about imagining the future. You cannot lead unless you are future oriented. Leadership is about change, and leadership is about hope. And I think I'd like to think the book is also about change, and it's also about hope.
I love that, and it's a great summary. So, Megan, my question to you is a bit more provocative, but at the same time, it touches your expertise, leadership, and dialogue. So we are in a very, I would say, if you look at history, it's a bit like the fall of the Roman Empire, that we had all these fantastic developments and all this technology, but we have a crisis of leadership, a crisis of truth, what we define by truth, and that's what we define by hope. And especially technology is somehow taking the humanity out of our innovation, which I think it's the first time probably in history where technology became abstract and it became cynic. And I think especially AI is creating a lot of problems on that. But at the same time, we have another problem that is definitely more geopolitical, is that if you look at the Western world with our democratic systems, and we are all based in the UK, which is, of course, a beacon of, I would say, interdisciplinarity and thought leadership. But if you look at most of the, let's say, the future that you mentioned, that's the next 50 years, most of the countries that are going to lead the next 50 years and the young people of these countries, because they are the majority, are not democratic. And they don't have the same values that we are discussing here. So we have definitely a big paradox between all the definition of truth, definition of dialogue, and then these kind of elements, and then the technology. So all these three things are creating a lot of uncertainty, but creating a lot of potential disruption that can go in a lot of directions. So how can we actually keep our feet and especially keep the leadership and dialogue on this? I know that is a big question.
Thank you for such an easy question there. Well, there's three easy steps. You do this, this, and this.
No, there's not.
Okay, so I don't think the technology is taking humanity out of our societies. I think, you know, the tech is driven by decisions that human beings are making. The tech is driven by the power structures of the human systems that we have in place. And so one thing that we, you know, I'll go back to something that I'm so interested in right now, is how do we create spaces where we are able to come together with diverse opinions and perspectives and reflect and make wiser choices. Now, for many people, the problem is, for many people, we're in a system our organizational systems and many of our societal systems are utterly focused on shorter term tangible results. And there's a perspective that if you create a space in order to reflect on something, that's a waste of time because you haven't got time to do it. And that is an utterly flawed and dangerous assumption. So how do I, as an individual leader, step out once in a while and go, okay, what is it that I'm actually doing here? Am I going in a direction that makes sense for me and the people that I love and care for around me? How do I, in the business schools that I work with, how do we stop delivering 3 million workshops a year and kind of, or at least we can still do that, but how do we create space to kind of go, what's our role here? How are we using our power in a way that we're really, really proud of? Because we're very powerful institutions here and we're training leaders and managers. So how can we make those sorts of choices? And in our organizational systems, the same is the case. You know, before we jump on the next AI kind of thing that's coming out, how do we create a space with people with different perspectives so that we can reflect? And what we need to do, and I don't know how to do this, Dennis, but I watch this space. How do we enable people to realize that the space, the reflection, the experimentation and the learning, and the ability to be with difference in a way that's curious and really interested, how do we enable people to realize that that is one of the most worthwhile things that they can possibly do, rather than, you know, thinking, I haven't got time, because I can't think of a more distressing misunderstanding than that. So that's where I'm at the moment. That's one thing that we have to do. We have to give ourselves a little bit of reflective time to make wise choices. And that's not easy.
I like that civility and the way you approach the problem. So I know that you guys have limit time. I really am very grateful. This is very inspiring for me. And I definitely will rethink a lot of things that were said here. And probably I'll ask a separate interview with each of you if you have time, because definitely I would like to touch a lot of these different things. So thank you, Des. Thank you, Megan. It's been an honor to have you here. I want to especially summarize you said here about the words and the key words: ingenuity, empathy, humility, and especially the capacity to learn how to ask when you don't know and say, I don't know. And I think this is a key element for leadership. And I would suggest for all the audience listening to us, please go to Thinkers 50 and engage with a wealth of knowledge that is available there. And as well, research more about Megan, about Des, because they have fantastic knowledge that it's key for everyone. It's been really an honor. Thank you both.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you. It's been a great conversation. Really enjoyed it.